Zurich until he found a suitable hotel, mid-priced and transient-friendly near the airport, then booked a room and put Belinda inside with a stash of food and water. Her facial expression told Jack she wasn't happy about the sequestration, but neither did she argue. Belinda Hahn had taken some body blows recently. Her father murdered, a stranger arriving on her doorstep to suggest her own boss may be involved, and her cabin blown out from under her. Whether she herself recognized it, Jack knew she was still in shock. Sleep was the best thing for her right now. Once satisfied with her promise to stay in the room, Jack drove the Citroen into downtown Zurich, where he picked up Alfred Escherstrasse and followed it to Lake Zurich. The sun was fully up and the lake's flat surface acted as a mirror. Jack pivoted the Citroen's visor to block the glare coming through his side window. In the hills surrounding the city, the pine trees were sprinkled with snow and the lake ice had melted, save for a few car-sized bergs. The villa to which Ephraim had tracked Eric Schrader sat on a stub of land jutting into the lake about halfway down its western shore and was sandwiched between two gated yacht clubs. With the exception of the latter, the location vaguely reminded Jack of his condo in Alexandria. That, and a price difference of 5 or 6 million, he estimated. At Ephraim's direction, Jack turned right on Seestrasse, or Lake Road, then followed its meandering, tree-lined course south until they reached the outskirts of the village of Wadenswil. Two more turns brought them to a frontage road not 20 feet from the shoreline. "Out your window," Ephraim said. "See the stone pillars and the black wrought-iron gate?" Jack did, but just barely. The villa's driveway was obscured by tall, tightly packed hedgerows and overhanging pine boughs. Without slowing the Citroen, Jack scanned the entrance for signs of security, but saw only a card reader mounted on a stone pillar. No cameras, no post for an attendant, and the ivy-covered wall on either side of the entrance was barely 6 feet tall, its crest made of smooth stone. Nor did Jack see any address placard. 10 feet through the gate, the driveway curved out of view. Jack kept driving, and the villa's entrance disappeared in his side mirror. "And this is where Schrader stayed?" he asked.
"Like he owned the place," Ephraim replied. "Used the card reader to get in."
"Have you done anything to find out who it belongs to?"
"Tried. When it comes to places like this, the Swiss treat property ownership the same way they treat their banking, with rigid privacy standards. Unless I missed seeing something, the perimeter is a piece of cake. Whether there's a security system on the house itself is another question."
"I can't believe I'm the voice of reason on this one, but what would we gain from breaking into the place? I'm guessing our hunch is right and it belongs to Alexander Bossard. What would we hope to find inside?"
It was a good question, and Jack didn't have an answer to it. They were unlikely to find a cardboard box labeled clues in one of the villa's closets, but they had few leads, and only two in Zurich, this villa and Alexander Bossard. He wasn't going to brush aside either of them without some due diligence first. That reminded Jack of something. "Have we heard back from Hacker Mitch yet on his hunt for Gerhard Klugman?"
"Hold on," Ephraim replied.
He pulled out his cell phone and sent a text. The reply was immediate. He read it, then said, "He's getting close. Today or tomorrow, he hopes. Push him a little bit." After Zurich, unless they decided to knock on the front door of Rostock Security Group's headquarters and ask to see Jürgen himself, they were out of leads. Getting to Klugman was the kind of break they needed. To kill time before nightfall, Jack drove into Zurich's Altstadt, or Old Town, to put eyes on Bossard's office building. The Altstadt, also known as District 1, was a collection of perfectly restored medieval buildings, Romanesque churches, postage stamp parks, and boutique shops and restaurants, all contained within a maze of alleys and streets sitting astride the Limmat River. The place reminded Jack of a real-life Santa's village. Jack saw few cars, but the sidewalks were crowded with what looked like locals and tourists alike, the former hurrying about their business,
the latter stopping every few feet to take pictures or gape at their surroundings. They found Bossard's building near the Grossminster, Great Minster Church, one of the city's oldest and most recognizable landmarks. "Built by the very hand of Charlemagne himself," Ephraim read from his phone's screen. "Or at least he commissions the original church on the site. It's almost 1,000 years old, if you can believe it." The bright morning sun highlighted a facade and stonework that were obviously well cared for. Jack replied, "Doesn't look a day over 800. Turn left here." Jack made the turn, then one more, and pulled onto Limmat Quay, which ran abreast of the river. As they approached it, Jack found himself surprised. Rather than a model of imposing medieval architecture, Bossard's 8-story office building was just one among a line of unremarkable structures, with cream or white facades and sharply pitched red-tiled roofs. If he hadn't known better, he might have mistaken them for hotels. The entrance to Bossard's building was a lone bronze door beneath a green awning. A small gold plaque beside the door read, 94 Limmat Quay. "Did you ever go inside?" Jack asked.
"No. You want me to?"
"You feel up to it?" Ephraim nodded.
"What am I looking for?"
Jack passed the building, found an open parking spot at the curb, and pulled in. Security cameras and/or guards, whether there's a manned reception desk, and if so, what's on it? Computer, telephone, intercom, and so on. Are the elevators open or access controlled?
You mean by key?
Or card? Same question if there's only a stairwell. Also, is there a visible emergency exit or any doors that look like they might lead to a utility room or closet? When you get inside, if there's a desk, just walk past it and head toward the stairs or elevators. See if you get a reaction, but don't push it. Don't be memorable.
And while I'm collecting this plethora of intelligence, what's my excuse for being there? Confused tourist. If there are cameras, do I hide my face?
Jack shook his head and smiled.
No, don't do that. I also need a rough map of the lobby and its approximate dimensions. And if you see a business directory, find out which businesses are directly above and below Bossard's floor.
Jeez. Anything else?
No.
Ephraim pursed his lips and exhaled heavily.
I guess it's a good thing I've got a stellar memory.
Don't spend more than 3 minutes in there. Get moving. Jack had chosen Ephraim's time limit arbitrarily. He'd seen John Clark milk a first reconnoiter for 20 or 30 minutes and walk out best friends with the person he'd just subtly interrogated. In this case, Jack wanted to see if Ephraim was going to follow orders. 2.5 minutes later, he emerged from the bronze door, walked back to the car, and climbed in.
Got it.
They drove a few blocks and found a cafe overlooking the Quay Bridge, which separated Lake Zurich from the Limmat River.
Let's hear it.
As though he'd given a surveillance report 100 times before, Ephraim described the building's lobby.
40 feet square, with a long horseshoe reception desk to the right, manned by a receptionist and a man in a business suit.
Did he stand when you came in?
Yes.
Did he smooth his tie or fiddle with his buttons when he stood up? Ephraim frowned.
Yes, actually. Why?
Habit. A lot of bodyguards pick it up. In a controlled environment, when someone unfamiliar pops onto their radar, it's a way of having their shooting hand halfway to their weapon. Keep going. On the reception desk, there's 2 telephones, 1 computer workstation, and a key card reader mounted on the raised counter. Past the desk, a bank of elevators, stairwell door, and an emergency exit. I counted 3 cameras, 1 overlooking the reception desk, 1 over the front door pointing inward, and 1 at the elevators. The waitress returned with their coffee, then left again. Jack asked, "Panning cameras or stationary?"
Stationary.
Exposed or shielded by a hood?
The latter, Ephraim replied.
It didn't look like the elevators or stairs required a key or card, but I didn't get very close to them before the guard called me back to the desk. He was very polite, but very firm.
This wasn't the place I was looking for. Please leave now.
Business directory? None in sight. Jack took all this in and nodded. Good job.
Thanks.
What's all that info mean? That unless we want to go in hard, breaking into Brossard's office after hours would probably get us caught, or killed, or both. Let's hope the villa pans out.
They sipped their coffee in silence for a while, watching the boats on the lake and soaking in the sun. Finally, Jack asked, "What did that security guard look like?"
6'2", maybe? Broad shoulders and blonde hair?
Why?
In the past 10 minutes, a green opal cargo van has passed us 3 times. Now it's parked down the street and across from that Starbucks. No one's gotten out. To his credit, Ephraim resisted the urge to turn around and look. He asked, "Can you see anyone inside?"
"Just one behind the wheel, but the sun's on the windshield. I can't see his face."
Jack wondered how many men could fit in the back of the van.
"What do we do?"
"Drink our coffee and wait."
Their shadow belonged to either Rostock or Bossard. But how had Jack and the others been tracked here?
While their foray to Zurich wasn't unpredictable, the city was sizable and the bad guys had picked up their trail in record time.
Belinda.
Jack dialed her cell phone, this one a burner she had no choice but to use, and waited through 4 rings before she answered.
"Just checking in," Jack said. "Everything okay?"
"Yes. Why? When are you coming back?"
"Soon as we can. Just make sure the door is locked. Don't answer it for anyone but us."
Jack disconnected.
What now?
He wasn't about to lead this van back to the motel. The trick would be to either turn the tables on their shadow or shake him in such a way that it appeared unintentional. Once again, here was a task where many hands would make short work. But Jack had limited hands, only one vehicle, and too little time for an elaborate plan. He said to Ephraim, "Get on your phone. I need a place that's remote, but within 15 or 20 minutes of here. Preferably somewhere with dead ends."
"I doubt I'll find it on Yelp, but I'll have a look," Ephraim replied. He browsed for a few minutes, then said, "There are a lot of little villages in the mountains west of here. The roads up there look pretty snaky."
"That'll do." They took their time finishing their coffee, then paid the bill and walked back to the Citroen. "Don't look for him," Jack warned Ephraim as they climbed in and Jack started the engine. With Ephraim navigating again, Jack crossed the K Bridge, merged onto Bäderstrasse with the rest of the lunch traffic, and headed west toward the foothills.
"He's with us," Jack said, glancing in his side mirror.
4 cars back, lane 1.
"Anyone in the passenger seat?"
"No." For the next 10 minutes, Jack kept heading west until finally they left the city behind and began climbing into the mountains. Almost immediately, the van began losing ground. It pulled onto the shoulder, waited for a line of cars to go by, then did a U-turn and headed back toward Zurich.
"He's not playing," Jack announced.
"Or he wasn't following us," Ephraim replied.
"Maybe."
Chapter 27. Zurich, Switzerland. At 9 p.m., they left the hotel and retraced their southerly route along Lake Zurich to Wadenswil. Here, just 15 miles outside Zurich proper, its night skyline appeared as a hazy dome of light on the horizon. Aside from its frequent passage through one of the 15 villages that ringed the left or western shoreline, the road south was dark and lightly traveled. Lake Zurich was more impressive than Jack had realized, reaching some 25 miles from Zurich in the north to Schmerikon in the south, and according to the fishing brochure at the hotel, more than 500 feet deep in several spots. As seemed to be par for the course, Jack had in his mind only a vaguely outlined plan. Based on their earlier reconnoiter, Jack knew getting over the villa's wall would present no problem, but the house itself was an unknown. Google Earth's overhead view had shown little of the structure beyond a hip and valley roof that was barely visible through the canopy, a lush lawn and an acre-size English-style garden on the property's western edge. For all Jack knew, the grounds were actively patrolled by a cadre of guards similar to the one Ephraim had seen in Bossard's office building. If so, Jack would probably be scrambling back over the wall before the lawn had a chance to moisten his shoes. Jack pulled into the Yacht Club Wadensville parking lot and doused the headlights, but left the engine running. The villa's outer wall was a quarter mile south through a cluster of trees. "Questions?" Jack asked.
"No, sir," Ephraim replied with a mock salute. "Orbit a half-mile route between Horgen und Wadensville and wait until I hear from you. If you text evac, I get back here at best speed. If I don't hear from you within 90 minutes, I pick up Belinda, move to the secondary hotel, wait another day, then leave, head to Brussels, and contact the U.S. Embassy."
Right. This last bit of instruction would likely prove worthless if Jack's penetration of the villa went bad. More than anything else, it was designed to get Ephraim and Belinda back to relatively safe territory. It would also have the added benefit of ruining Ephraim's investigation. If there was no story left to pursue, he might live to see 30.
"Why the Brussels embassy?" Ephraim asked. "Why not the one in Bern?"
"They know my name in Brussels. You'll get more immediate action." Though Jack had a hard time saying this with a straight face, the explanation seemed to satisfy Ephraim.
"Consider it done," he said. "Good hunting."
As Ephraim pulled the Citroën out of the lot and back onto the road, Jack walked into the trees, where he paused to let his eyes adjust to the darkness before continuing on until the villa's stone wall came into view. The trees were thicker here and probably hadn't been trimmed for years. Branches crisscrossed the top of the wall and jutted over the property. While the overgrowth lessened the likelihood of any surveillance cameras picking him up, it also surrounded him in almost complete darkness. Now he regretted his decision to not replace the night vision goggles he'd lost in Munich. "Deal with it, Jack." He turned right and followed the wall to its western corner. Here was the most likely place for a camera. Corner-positioned cameras offered the most bang for the buck, but they also had built-in blind spots. Jack saw no camera. Now came the less than glamorous part of being a special operator: the waiting and watching. Stealth was as much about stillness as it was about skulking. If his approach had attracted attention, he'd be getting visitors soon enough. He sat cross-legged on the ground, his back against a tree trunk, and donned his portable radio's headset. He keyed the talk button.
"Ephraim, you there?"
"I'm here. Making the turn back north. I'll be driving past the gate again in about 2 minutes."
10 minutes passed. Aside from some faint boat engine sounds coming from the direction of the lake, all was quiet. A rabbit hopped into view along the wall, spotted Jack, then sprinted away. Long enough. He was anxious to get in and get out. He approached the wall, grabbed its top with both hands, and hop vaulted so his chin was level with the capstone. On the other side was a mulched planting bed interspersed with white tulips and cedar bushes. Jack pulled himself up, flipped his leg over the wall's crest, then rolled over and dropped to the ground behind one of the bushes. Ahead he could see the curved black edge of the asphalt driveway. The main gate was somewhere to his right. He headed that way until the wrought iron gate came into view, then crossed the driveway and ducked behind a hedgerow. Jack continued like this for another 15 minutes, partly to hunt for any patrolling guards, partly to get a better look at the villa itself, a two-story structure done in French farmhouse style. Switzerland was a country of 4 official languages, German, French, Italian, and a bit of Romance, and the architecture and culture reflected this. The more expensive homes along Lake Zurich seemed to be a mixture of design styles, from Old World Tuscan to German neo-modern. By the time Jack reached the villa's lakeside, he was convinced he was alone on the grounds. He'd seen no lights and no movement in or around the villa, so unless the occupants had turned in very early, no one was home. Jack emerged from his hiding spot and strode across the lawn to the villa's rear patio, a slab of herringbone paving stones, complete with a sunken grotto hot tub whose surface was choked with leaves and twigs. Jack switched his pen light to red, clicked it on, checked the patio doors and nearby windows for signs of an alarm system. Again, there was nothing. Apparently, Lake Zurich wasn't known for its high crime rate. Jack half wondered if the villa's doors locked, but a quick check of the patio door answered his question. Ephraim's voice came over Jack's headset. "Jack, I've got a vehicle parked about 100 meters north of the villa gate. I think it may be that green cargo van we saw earlier." "Give me a percentage of certainty," Jack replied. 8%? "This one's got an electrician's placard on the side, but it looked crooked. Might be a stick-on." "Are you sure it wasn't there before?" "No, not sure at all. Sorry. You want me to get closer and check the license plate? Or maybe see if someone's inside?" "No, leave it." Ephraim didn't reply immediately, so Jack asked, "Are you hearing me? Stay away from it."
"Okay, I hear you."
"Tighten up your loop so you pass the van every few minutes. If he starts following you, drive into Horgan and find as public a place as you can find and stay there. Keep me posted." In turn, Jack checked each of the villa's first-floor mullioned windows. All seemed to be bedrooms, except for the corner room, which looked to be a study library. A computer monitor sat atop the walnut desk. Jack pulled a roll of masking tape and a glass punch from his rucksack, then taped an asterisk over the window's lower left pane and pressed the punch into the glass until it shattered with a muffled tinkling. Carefully, he peeled away the sections of taped glass, then reached inside and unlocked the window and climbed through. He went still and scanned the room for blinking lights or the telltale soft clicking of a triggered motion detector. There was neither. Too easy, Jack thought, a bit worried. In the United States, a luxury home of this caliber would be bristling with surveillance cameras and alarm systems. Count your good luck and keep moving. He pulled the window curtains closed, then sat down at the desk and powered up the computer. When the desktop appeared, a username password dialog box popped up. Jack switched his headset plug from the portable radio to his cell phone and dialed Mitch, whom he'd asked to stand by should Jack run into this very problem. When Mitch answered, Jack explained the situation.
"Well, there's no sense trying to brute force the thing," Mitch said. "Permutations are in the billions. You got the flash drive I gave Ephraim?"
"Yes."
"Let's try this first. Restart the computer, but hold down the Command and R buttons as you do it."
"Recovery mode?" Jack asked.
"Yeah, you know what it looks like then. Let's try the easy way first."
Once the computer's recovery mode dialog box appeared, Mitch had Jack navigate to the utilities drop-down menu.
"You're looking for terminal," Mitch explained.
"It's there, but it's ghosted out. I can't select it."
"Worth a shot. Okay, insert that flash drive and do a force restart."
Jack did this, and a black screen with a blinking orange cursor appeared. Mitch said, "Type run into the command line, then sit back and wait."
"How long?"
"Depends on the size of the hard drive and whether the owner's running any third-party password or encryption protocols. 10 minutes, give or take. You should see a progress bar. The words run stop will appear below the command line."
On Jack's belt, the portable radio flashed. He told Mitch, "I'll call you back," then switched the headset over, turned up the radio's volume and said,
"Ephraim, what?"
"Over the wall."
"What? Say again."
"Whoever was in that van just hopped over the wall. They're coming your way. Should I?"
"No, keep circling, but stay close to the yacht club parking lot."
"Just one, you're sure?"
"I only saw one."
"Stay off the radio unless it's absolutely necessary. I'll be in touch. Same thing applies. 2 hours and you run."
Jack turned the computer's monitor so its light was shining away from the window, then peeked through the curtains in time to see a figure sprinting across the lawn and around to the villa's lakeside. Jack checked the computer's progress bar. 90% to go. Did he sit tight or go hunting?
If this new player was responding to Jack's tampering with the computer, the chances were good he'd come straight to this study. Then again, why hop the wall rather than use the gate? Why post yourself outside the property rather than inside the villa itself? Those were questions for later. Right now, he needed to be proactive. Go hunting. He didn't want to be trapped in this room with only the window for an escape route. He eased open the study door and poked his head out. To his left was a long hallway of dark, tumbled stone tile. Beyond the hallway, he could see what looked like a living room, decorated in robin's egg blue and white shabby chic. To his right, through an open arch, a winding stairway led to the second floor. Jack heard what sounded like a burst from a dental drill, followed by a soft double snick. He recognized the noise, an electric lockpick tool known as a snap gun. Whoever was coming, they weren't wasting any time. Jack raised the HK and crept down the hallway to the living room, where he paused to listen. He heard another sound, this one a door clicking shut, somewhere to his right. He looked around the corner. Through an archway was the villa's kitchen. As Jack watched, the back door swung open an inch, then went still. Jack took aim. The door moved again, just a few more inches, then clicked shut again. Wind, Jack thought. Probably. Jack kept his gun trained on the door, but let his eyes glide to either side of it, watching for movement. If the intruder had come through this door, what options did he have? Take cover behind the kitchen counter, or slip into the nook, or come through the living room arch toward Jack? Or, to the right of the back door was another set of stairs leading to the second floor. As if on cue, Jack heard a floorboard creak above his head. If the intruder was familiar with the villa, he might be crossing the second floor to the stairway behind Jack. Jack pivoted slowly on his heel, aimed the HK down the hall and waited for a five count, then pivoted back toward the living room. From the second floor came a soft crash, as though someone had bumped a piece of furniture. Move now. With the HK raised and tracking, Jack paced through the arch and into the kitchen. A quick glance left told him the nook was clear. He circled behind the kitchen counter, saw no one hiding there, and continued toward the stairway door. As he approached it, a semi-automatic pistol poked through the opening, almost crossing Jack's own weapon. Startled, he stepped back. His heel rapped against the baseboard. A figure rushed through the door, gun coming around to bear on Jack. The man's stance was straight-armed and overextended. Jack took advantage of this, batting aside the man's gun, stepping in close, and snapping the point of his elbow into the man's head. The man grunted but went along with the blow, using its momentum to coil his body for a counterpunch. Jack lifted his knee, slowing the strike, but not enough. The man's fist landed just below Jack's bottom rib. He gasped and bent sideways and felt his left leg buckle. Strong and fast, son of a bitch. Jack drove his still-raised knee downward. His boot heel slammed into the tile, clipping the inner edge of the man's foot. The man yelped in pain. Jack repeated the maneuver, this time raking his boot's knurled edge down the length of the man's shin before stomping the man's foot a second time. Now the man collapsed sideways. Jack helped him, palming the side of his head and banging it against the door jamb. The man dropped his gun. Jack kicked it, sending it twirling across the tile floor, then took a rapid step back and leveled the HK with the man's head. "Are you done?" Jack asked, panting. The man tried to get up, pressing himself off the floor with his left hand. Jack stepped forward and kicked it out from under him. He collapsed and his head banged against the tile. "I said, are you done?" Jack said. "J'ai fini," the man replied. And then he added in lightly accented English, "I am done." Jack clicked on his penlight. "Let me see your face." "Why?" "Show me your face," Jack growled. Slowly, the man lifted his head. It was René Almond. Chapter 28. Wadensville, Switzerland.
We've been looking for you,
Jack said.
Many people have been looking for me,
Almond replied. He sat upright and began massaging his shin and foot.
Can you stop shining that light in my eyes?
Jack lowered the beam slightly. He keyed his radio and said, What's happening out there? Do we have any more company? Ephraim replied, No. What's happening in there? Everything's fine. Stand by.
Almond asked Jack, Who are you? Who are you talking to?
Jack paused to consider his answers. While he tended to agree with Ephraim that René Almond was a victim in all this, there was a chance they were both wrong.
I can tell you who I'm not, he replied. I'm not one of Jürgen Rostock's people.
This got Almond's attention. He looked up at Jack with narrowed eyes.
What does that mean?
It means you're not the only one who's pissed off Herr General. Do you know a man named Erich Schroeder? Very tall, German?
Perhaps.
You met with him in Lyon.
Almond didn't reply.
Jack decided to go all in. After you two parted company, he flew to the United States and tried to slit my throat.
Almond offered a Gallic shrug. Well, it appears he didn't succeed.
No, but it was close. He's dead now.
You killed him?
Not exactly, but the result was the same.
Captain Almond, in case you hadn't noticed, you're still alive, and you're not zip-tied in the trunk of a car. If I was with RSG, we wouldn't be talking.
What you say makes some sense, but it doesn't explain why you're here and why you've been looking for me.
Jack was getting annoyed with their uneven information exchange. Then he reminded himself what René Almond had been through. In fact, something told Jack he and Ephraim probably knew only a fraction of the story.
I know about Abidjan, Jack said. At least part of it. I don't think you had anything to do with the attacks in Lyon. And I'd bet money there was a lot more to your kidnapping than anyone knows.
Almond smiled. And now this is the part where I unburden myself and we become fast friends, yes?
That's your call. As soon as I get done cloning the hard drive on the computer in that study, the one I believe belongs to Alexander Bossard, I'm leaving. You can either come with me and look at the data, or go to ground again and pray you find a way to clear your name and get your life back. You decide.
Jack was reasonably confident he'd gained a sliver of trust from Almond, but not so confident he would risk turning his back on the man. After collecting Almond's weapon, a Walther P-22, Jack returned to the study to find Mitch's flash drive had nearly finished its task. Jack sat down before the computer and watched the progress bar inch closer to 100%. Almond appeared in the study's doorway.
Can I have my gun back?
I'll leave it beside the wall by the front gate, Jack replied. Or you can join us for coffee and I'll give it back to you then.
Us? It's not just you.
No. We come as a package deal, though. If you're going to trust me, you'll have to trust him.
I do not think we are quite at trust yet, do you?
Jack offered Almond what he hoped was his best, couldn't care less shrug. They desperately needed Almond's cooperation, but Jack's gut told him playing hard to get was the smart move. There's an all-night coffee house in Wadensville, right off the Zugerstrasse and across from the police station. We'll be there for the next hour. Jack removed the flash drive, powered down the computer, and stood up. And you might want to retrace your steps before you leave.
Pardon?
You're not wearing gloves. If you don't want your fingerprints found here, I'd wipe down everything you touched. Jack and Ephraim hadn't gotten through their first cups of coffee when they saw, through their booth's window, Almond's van pull into the parking lot. The electrician's placard was gone. Jack said to Ephraim, Good call about that, by the way.
Ephraim smiled. I'm a learner.
Almond walked inside and the hostess approached him. He gestured toward Jack and Ephraim, then walked over. He grabbed a chair from a nearby table, plopped it down at the end of their booth, and sat. To Jack, he said,
This is your partner?
Yes. Do I get my gun back now?
Jack nodded at the folded newspaper on the table. In there. It's not loaded. Leave it that way until you're back in the van.
Almond made no move to touch the newspaper.
You know my name, but I don't know yours.
Jack made the introductions, first names only. Almond shook their hands and said,
René.
Jack, you said Eric Schroeder is dead. Is that true?
Google it. Alexandria, Virginia. Unidentified man walks into oncoming traffic and is killed instantly.
That's unfortunate. I was hoping to catch up to him. We were overdue for a chat.
Almond smiled when he said this, but there was none of it in his eyes. Jack suspected that if Schroeder hadn't died in Alexandria, he wouldn't have survived his run-in with Almond. Jack assumed their chat would have involved power tools and electricity. If so, Jack wondered, had Almond already had that kind of brutality in him? Or had his experiences since Ivory Coast taken him to that dark place? The waitress appeared and asked if Almond wanted anything. He waved her off. Once she was out of earshot, he said,
So, how do we proceed, the three of us?
Jack and Ephraim had discussed this. They'd decided to lay everything out for René and hope they were bringing something valuable to the table. Jack said, Ephraim tells you his story, then I tell you mine.
And if I do not want to share my own?
Jack answered with a little steel in his voice.
Then that's on you. Get in your van and leave, but stay out of our way.
Ephraim,
tell him.
Ephraim took Almond through his story, starting with Fabrice, the cafe owner in Abidjan, then his tailing Eric Schroeder after Almond's meeting with Madeleine in the Parc de la Fessine, then finally his encounter with Jack and Stefan Muller at the nature preserve.
That was you in the Parc de la Fessine? Asked Almond. I thought I might have picked up a tail, but after I left it was gone. Madeleine brought you to our meeting, truly.
She's worried about you. She's trying to help.
Almond frowned. It was almost a snarl.
I shouldn't have called her. Sentimentality is weakness.
So, you followed Schroeder to Virginia, then found this Muller person.
Jack asked, you've never heard the name? When Almond shook his head, Jack showed him a screen capture from the Westhaven gas station surveillance camera. He's since lost his beard.
Doesn't look familiar. You think he's with Rostock?
We have no evidence of a connection. To Muller or Schroeder. Do you?
Nothing that would suffice in court.
This statement surprised Jack. Was Almond merely using a colloquialism, or did he really believe this situation could be resolved on the white side of the law?
Please, go on, Almond said. After the nature preserve.
Jack continued the story, but first backtracked to the attack at the supermercado before recounting their hunt for Muller, his escape at the Vermont airstrip, their foray into Munich, then their meeting at the villa. Ephraim asked Almond,
You were tailing us this morning. How did you know we'd be here tonight?
Like you, I had to leave Munich in a hurry. The only other trail I could follow was the same one that brought you here. Alexander Bossard and Schroeder. I've been here for a week. I set up real-time game cameras in the trees across from the villa, hoping either Bossard or someone else would show up. He's impossible to get to at his office or his apartment in the city. I saw you pass by the villa a few times, got curious, and drove down here. I picked you up on your way back to Zurich.
Jack, why would Jürgen Rostock want you dead?
I was hoping you could tell me.
I can't.
Ephraim has a theory about you, Jack said. He thinks you were false flagged. That's when I know what it is.
What makes you think that, Ephraim?
It's what you said to Madeleine. He isn't who he claims to be.
Almond shook his head, scratched furiously at his arm, then replied,
I don't recall saying that.
Not good enough, Jack replied. He shoved the newspaper toward Almond. Time for you to go.
Pardon me? We've been straight with you. If you're not going to reciprocate, we've got no use for you. In fact, from what I can tell, you're more of a liability than an asset.
Jack intended this last comment to sting, and the change in Almond's eyes told him it had worked. We'll be better off without you.
Almond said nothing for several seconds.
It's difficult, you must realize. I don't have a home. Madeline is the only person from my former life that knows I'm alive, and a good portion of my fellow Frenchmen think I died either a deserter or a traitor, and therefore got what I deserved. Jürgen Rostock is a powerful man. I've been walking on a razor's edge since Abidjan. I feel like I'm sometimes in a dream, other times not. And now, to find out my Madeleine confided in a reporter. Is it hard to see why trust is hard for me?
I get it. I do, Jack replied. But here's what I know, Renee. Whatever your connection is to Rostock, it's a miracle you're still alive. I don't think you'll last out here on your own much longer. You've got to trust somebody sometime. Whether that's us, only you can decide.
Almond, who'd been staring at his hands, clasping and unclasping them while Jack was talking, now looked up. He held Jack's gaze for a long 5 seconds. Almond's eyes were twitching slightly. He said,
"What do you want to know?"
Chapter 29. Wadensville, Switzerland.
Let's go back to the start, Jack replied. What happened in Abidjan?
The night they took me, I was going to meet a girl, a Red Cross worker from Strasbourg. We met when her orientation group came to get some basic first aid training before going into the field.
What's her name? Ephraim asked.
Almond thought for a moment.
Jeanine Pelletier. No, Perrier. That's it.
Do you have a picture of her? Jack asked.
Perhaps in my OneDrive account.
René got out his phone, tapped a few keys, then handed it to Jack. He studied the photo and returned the phone to René. Go on, he said.
Not long after I got there, a van pulled up. 5 men in balaclavas poured out, swarmed me, put a hood over my head, and shoved me into the van. It happened so fast.
Almond shook his head.
I barely put up a struggle. I was so shocked. After that, it was all something of a blur. We drove for hours, I don't know in which direction, but it was almost dawn when the van stopped. I was put in a basement, I think, in a small brick room with no windows.
Ephraim asked, did anyone speak to you, ask you anything?
No, and that made it all the worse.
No one said a word, not from the time I was taken to the day I got free. Once a day, every day, someone would come into the room wearing the same balaclava, give me food and water and change my waste bucket, then leave. A couple times a day, 2 or 3 of them would come in, beat me and kick me until I passed out. Every few days another one would come in, put a gun to my head and pull the trigger. But the gun was always empty.
Several times they had me stand on a chair with my head in a noose, and they would simply watch me, for hours. There were other things, too, but I can't.
Almond's words trailed off. How did you get free?
I was rescued. One night, very late, I heard 2 explosions. I recognized them as flashbangs. You know, stun grenades. And then there was a lot of automatic weapons fire. About 10 minutes after it started, the door to my cell opened and a pair of men in camouflage came in. They told me they'd come to rescue me. They took me somewhere by vehicle, maybe Abidjan, but I can't be sure.
It was a private home, some kind of compound. Waiting for me was a doctor and a nurse. I had broken bones, torn ligaments and muscles, contusions on my liver and spleen. Even with the medication, the pain was indescribable. A few days later, Jürgen Rostock showed up.
It was his men who rescued me, he told me.
From there, we moved around a lot. Rostock told me my life was in danger, that people were hunting for me, that it had something to do with my father and the Army Defense Staff. I never quite understood it. I was fuzzy, you know, from the drugs. But eventually, after about 6 weeks, Rostock said they'd eliminated the threat.
Which was what? Asked Ephraim.
Almond shook his head.
I'm not sure. I'm sorry, it's...
That's okay, Jack said.
Was Rene a junkie? He wondered.
Rene's demeanor suggested a narcotic addiction, perhaps to oxycodone. His injuries certainly warranted such a prescription.
Pieces began falling into place for Jack. What kind of group, terrorist or otherwise, kidnaps a soldier from a famous family, no less, but claims no credit for it and asks for no ransom?
His captors had tortured him, but had neither asked him questions nor tried to coerce him into some trumped-up inflammatory confession.
And what about after his rescue? Rostock had made no effort to return Rene to his loved ones.
And then there was the constant moving about, the vague, looming threats to Rene's life, the insinuations about his father. And through all of this, Jürgen Rostock and his men were the only ones looking out for him, the only ones who could keep the boogeymen at bay. Seeing it now with fresh eyes, Jack recognized Rene Allemand's odyssey for what it was, an elaborately choreographed brainwashing program. But to what end?
To answer that question, Jack had to first determine whether Rene understood the true nature of what had happened to him. There was a larger worry as well. How reliable was he at all?
He'd been kidnapped, that much was fact. But they had only his account of what happened after he was thrown into that van in Abidjan.
What happened next? Asked Jack.
Rene replied with a proud grin. Rostock offered me a job.
Ephraim leaned forward.
What? What do you mean?
A job in his company. He offered me a position as a field officer.
I'd heard of RSG and knew of its reputation, but I'd always assumed my career would be in the French army. What happened in Abidjan, and then what Jürgen and I talked about, made me reconsider. I took the job.
And you never thought to contact your father or the army to let them know you were alive? Why, for God's sake?
At first, it was at Rostock's suggestion. I was going to be doing undercover work, he said, and the training and transition were going to be intense. Once I was past that, Rostock was going to help me get my old life back. Later, well, I'm not sure why.
Ephraim's mouth was hanging open. He said, Are you suggesting you participated in faking your own death to join RSG? That you were going to be part of some secret... What, exactly? What was Rostock asking you to do?
Almond stared vacantly at Ephraim, his face a mask of frustration and confusion. Clearly he wanted to, and should have been able to answer Ephraim's question. But there was a disconnect somewhere in Almond's brain, related either to his addiction or to his treatment at the hands of Rostock, or a combination of the two.
Ephraim said to Jack, Christ almighty, this guy is out there.
Jack cut him off.
We're just having trouble following this, Rene.
Yes, of course. These are not simple issues we're dealing with. The world, I mean. We're on the brink of a precipice.
Again, Allman's words trailed off, as though he'd lost his place in a script.
Jack felt a wave of sympathy for Rene, but it was tainted by a gut punch of fear. He'd already felt he and Ephraim had dropped into the rabbit hole. Sitting across from Rene, Jack now felt like he'd met the Mad Hatter, or the White Rabbit.
None of this was Rene's fault, of course, but Jack now realized they'd joined forces with a highly trained soldier who not only had lost touch with reality, but was probably suffering from a narcotics addiction and PTSD.
Abruptly, Renee stood up.
I need the restroom.
Down that hall and left, Jack replied. Almond walked away. Ephraim leaned across the table at Jack and rasped,
The man is insane, Jack.
Hold on.
No, I've spent a long time on this story, maxed out my credit cards, and almost gotten myself killed chasing a lunatic. We've got to get out of here. I'm done, Jack. Let's go.
Ephraim moved to stand up.
We're not going anywhere, Jack snapped. Sit down. You're not seeing it, are you? What?
Rene was kidnapped, and he was held, and he was rescued, but it's all Rostock. Jack spent the next 2 minutes explaining his theory, until slowly Ephraim's expression softened.
Jack, brainwashing? That's Manchurian candidate stuff. Science fiction.
You'd be surprised. I think what happened to Rene is an extreme form of operant conditioning combined with drug therapy. Negative reinforcement, isolation, threat of extinction, desocialization, a skewed version of Stockholm syndrome. It's all there. It's what he went through, from the time he was kidnapped until Rostock offered him a job.
If that's the case, why is he on the run from Rostock?
I think he knows something's not right about all this, but he can't pin it down. It's like trying to grab a fistful of water. 1 minute he's suspicious of Rostock, the next praising him. Almon either saw or heard something that spooked him, something that contradicted his conditioning. So he bolted.
Let's just assume you're right. Why him? Aside from his famous name, right now he's just another soldier. Why would Rostock go to all this trouble?
I don't think it's got anything to do with Rene. This is about his father, Marshal Almon.
In what way?
I don't know yet. But as a coercion technique, what Rostock's done is brilliant. If you kidnap a child, your leverage lasts only as long as you have control of that child. Same with threatening the child's life. But what happens when you take the child's mind and turn it against the parent?
A puppet, Ephraim replied.
A puppet whose narrative and fate you control. Jack added. Rene is either a heroic French soldier who survived a horrendous experience, or he's a traitor to his country. To someone like Marshal Almond, that's a powerful lever.
The question was, a lever to accomplish what?
Ephraim's eyes had glazed over.
Kidnapping, he murmured.
What? Ephraim held up his finger for Jack to wait. He got out his cell phone, browsed for a minute, then said,
Son of a bitch. I knew I'd read something about this. Rene wasn't Rostock's first victim. 5 years ago, Alexander Bossard's daughter Suzette was kidnapped in Brazil. RSG rescued her.
Save a man's child, and you could own him for life. It's a hell of a debt to repay, Ephraim said.
So what do we do with Rene?
In the long term, that's a question for a psychologist. In the short term, Rene's going to keep going until he assembles the puzzle in his head or Rostock kills him. If we keep him close, we can at least steer him a bit. Almond returned to the booth and sat down. He drummed his fingers on the table and looked at each of them in turn.
You have more questions, yes?
You said you and Rostock talked, Jack replied. About what?
What else? Islamic terrorism. It has to be stopped.
Jack didn't disagree, but Renee's tone had been condescending, as though Jack had asked what should be done with a lawn that needed to be mowed.
You mow it, idiot.
How?
Not the way we've been doing it here, or in the United States for that matter. It's time to remove the gloves, as you might say. We root them out, wherever they are, and kill them all. If you help a terrorist, you are yourself a terrorist. If you sympathize with a terrorist, you are yourself a terrorist. We've been treating this like a conventional war. That's ludicrous. We need to go nuclear.
As he'd been speaking, Rene's tone had become increasingly strident,
and now he punctuated this last statement by jabbing the table with his index finger.
"You mean literally or figuratively?" asked Ephraim.
"Whatever it takes. Nation-state armies are worthless in this kind of fight. Too many laws, regulations, rules of engagement. Governments come and go, as does political will. Terrorists don't bother with those things. We can't afford to either. It has to stop. Don't you see that? We have to stop them before it's too late. Rostock's approach is the only one that can work."
Jack thought, the looming threat, the ticking clock, and the savior. Three more operant conditioning techniques.
"What approach?" asked Ephraim.
Almond was gazing out the window. After a couple seconds, he snapped his head toward Ephraim.
"What?"
"I said..." Jack broke in. "Maybe you can help me understand something. If you believe in Rostock's message, why are you running from him?"
"Schrader," Almond replied simply. "I didn't trust him. He was my contact, my training officer. But there was something about him. I started following him."
"And?" asked Ephraim.
"Did you follow the Lyon attacks?"
Both Jack and Ephraim nodded.
"Do you remember the bomb maker's apartment they found a week later, near that pharmacy, and the makeshift shooting range outside Montenay? A few days before the attacks, Schrader visited both places."
Jack was stunned. Provided this wasn't a delusion of Grenet's, Eric Schrader, one of Jürgen Rostock's operatives, had been involved in the Lyon attacks.
"But Schrader was working for Rostock," Ephraim said. "No, I think he turned. I was trying to get proof to take to Jürgen. I didn't know who else at RSG might be allied with Schrader, so I decided to handle it myself. And it's a good thing I did. Schrader and Alexander Bossard met a number of times with Rostock present."
Once again, Almond's reasoning was muddled. Schrader was a rogue agent, and Rostock a terrorist-fighting savior who couldn't see what was happening under his own nose. Jack suspected part of Renee's mind was pushing him toward the truth about both Rostock and what had happened to him in Abidjan, but he couldn't yet make the leap. What would happen when the man had no choice but to face that chasm?
Chapter 30. Wadenswil, Switzerland.
Halfway through Almond's revelation, Jack had decided it was time to get Belinda Hahn out of harm's way. He'd been leaning in that direction already, but Renee's instability forced the issue. Plus, Almond's trust of Jack and Ephraim was tenuous. Belinda's presence might be too much for the soldier. As it turned out, Almond's van had been serving as his command post and mobile living quarters. Jack convinced him to follow them back to the motel, then sent Ephraim up to the room while he and Almond sat in the van. During the drive, Ephraim had called his mother in Brussels to arrange for Belinda's safekeeping. Ephraim called a few minutes later.
"She's ready to go. There's a red eye leaving in a few hours. I'll drive her, then come back. We're coming down now."
"Good. Drive safe." Jack waited a few minutes to ensure Ephraim and Belinda were gone, then led Renee up to the room. Jack ordered pizza, and then while Renee took a shower, he plugged the flash drive into his laptop and uploaded the data to Mitch's private server. Mitch called a few minutes later as Renee emerged from the bathroom. Mitch said, "Jack, there were no documents of interest on that computer, but I did find something interesting in the browser history. Looks like a business portal. Is this guy an attorney in Zurich?"
"Yes."
"Then yeah, it fits. I don't know what kind of encryption and firewalls I'll find on the portal's server side, but I'll get started and keep you posted. Anything specific I should be keying on?" "For starters, any mention of Jürgen Rostock or Rostock Security Group or similar combinations. Throw my name in the mix, too." Jack lowered his voice, then added, "And any mention of a Jeanine Perrier. She may have worked for the Red Cross."
"Got it."
Jack disconnected. Almond asked, "Who was that?"
We've got a guy working on the data from the villa, Jack replied.
Why are there 3 toothbrushes in the bathroom?
What?
There are 2 of you.
But 3 toothbrushes, said Renee.
Is there someone else staying with you?
No, said Jack. I must have packed 2 by mistake.
Renee considered this, then nodded.
Mind if I use one? I have no running water in the van. My teeth feel like they're wearing socks.
Ephraim returned 3 hours later. Renee had fallen asleep in the armchair an hour earlier, which Jack took as a good sign. You don't sleep around people you can't trust, especially someone in Almond's condition. Jack was sitting at the table, willing his phone to ring.
There's a few pieces of pizza left, he whispered, nodding at the box.
Ephraim sat down, fished out a piece, and took a bite.
Jack asked, What do you think about Leon?
You mean about Schrader being involved in the attacks?
If it's true, there's no way a guy like Schrader could orchestrate something like that.
Rostock could, though.
I agree.
Rostock's kidnapping and rescue of Almond was a type of false flag operation. Staging a terrorist attack and then pinning it on another group, though more complex in scope, wasn't dissimilar in principle.
The group that claimed credit, the Sahrawi Islamic Liberation Army, dropped off the radar, didn't it?
Ephraim nodded.
Officials I talked to in both Lyon and Paris claimed to know nothing about Sila.